Second.
You're right.
Good afternoon, and welcome. And welcome to this joint hearing of two subcommittees, Environment and Natural Resources Subcommittee of the Finance Committee of Environment and Natural Resources Budget. This is a mouthful. And the Forestry Subcommittee of the Natural Resources Environment Policy Committee. I see Senator Chaudhry's computer's here, but he's not here, but we would expect it. He just snuck in.
We'll be expecting him to show up any moment, right?
We have an interesting agenda. We've had a working group that's been spending time, and most of the testifiers are out of that working group. And what we're dealing with, for the most part, is a fragmentation of our forests. Fragmentation meaning large private developments on large private tracts, the breaking up and development of that, and of course it creates difficulties for our forest products industry, for our recreation industries, and certainly for wildlife management when those large forests are broken up. We're also dealing, in particular on public lands, with forest land consolidation. That meaning, Minnesota has about 16 million acres of forests, and of that, about 4.5 million are state and county tax forfeit, a little over 2. The federal forests are about 2.5 million acres, and then the private large industrials are about 1 million acres, and then we've got the 6 million of small non-industrial lands. The best example we can give, and we've watched this over the past year, is let's say you have a piece of county land that's embedded in a piece of state land, meaning that county land is going to be very difficult to manage. If, in fact, then we could in some way see an outright purchase or do a land exchange, we think that it'd be much easier to manage these lands, and that's one of the things we'll be talking about today. So these testifiers that you'll hear today either have ideas or ideas for some legislation that we may see coming up this year, and we're looking forward to hearing from them. And the first person that is there any comment from any of the committee before we start? Great. The first person on the agenda is Dave Zemeta, who's head of the Minnesota Forest Resources Council. And welcome, Dave. And you probably should state your name and position for the record and then go ahead. You're going to be talking about some potential funding we see coming along.
Yes. My name's Dave Zemeta. I'm executive director of the Minnesota Forest Resources Council. With me, in case you have any questions, is Dr. Calder Hibbard, who's policy analyst for the Forest Resources Council. In your packet, you should have a overhead with a few slides on it, and I'm just going to speak from that. It's entitled Minnesota Forest Resources Council Working Forest Land Conservation Initiative. I appreciate the opportunity to testify today, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. The parcelization, which is the breaking down of larger parcels of forest land into smaller parcels of forest land, is occurring fairly rapidly on Minnesota's private forest land, and there's pronounced effects of this parcelization on wildlife habitat, timber availability, water quality, land cover, recreational access. This is why it's a concern. As a result of that, the council, really at the request of some legislators, came up with this Working Forest Land Conservation Initiative, and there's three components to it. First is an assessment of trends, drivers, and effects of forest parcelization, and also looking at the relationship between parcelization and subsequent development. Second is an assessment of different policy responses that the legislature could use to address these trends. And then finally, it would be recommendations to the legislature as to which of those tools would be most appropriate to consider. The Council has been successful in obtaining $150,000 out of the $200,000 that we have sought for this proposal. $100,000 from the Blandon Foundation has been pledged, and $50,000 from Ironman Resources. Both grants, however, are contingent on receiving full funding to conduct the study, that is the additional $50,000, and the Blandon grant in particular is contingent that on those funds being, quote, legislative matching support, unquote. So we have $150,000 in hand, but we need the other $50,000 to get these funds and complete the study. I'll skip over current conditions and impacts. You've heard a lot of this in the past, and for the sake of time, I think I'll just move on. The assessment of trends, drivers, and effects, what we would really look at in this study, where is parcelization occurring, how much of it is occurring, how fast is it occurring. We funded a preliminary study of this in Itasca County and got some very interesting results from that with funding in previous year. And Dr. Kilgore will be presenting that to you later in this hearing. His research shows that, indeed, at least in Itasca County, parcelization does lead to development, and he'll say some more about that with some empirical data from Itasca County. The study will look at what conditions encourage parcelization and how parcelization affects the benefits from working forests, generally adversely. The different policy options we'd look at include fee title ownership of land, conservation easements, land exchange, education and informational assistance to landowners, technical assistance, tax policy, both property and estate taxes, planning and zoning, and then there's various other approaches that we'd assess. And then the recommendations would focus on four areas: maximizing forest land conserved while minimizing the cost, addressing the complementary nature of the different policy options, roles and responsibilities of the different agencies and private entities that would need to be involved in conserving our private forest lands, and then the need for periodic review or long-term monitoring. And with that, I think I'll stop, and I'd be happy to take any questions that you have. Senator Saxod.
Thank you, Mr. Zemeta. Are there any questions of the committee? I don't know if we should get into too much questioning, Dave, because one of our problems here is that many of the questions will probably be answered in some of the next testifiers.
Absolutely.
So. But again, we know that this study that you're contemplating is going to be a good one, and it's going to be a real key to the future of our strategies for trying to limit parcelization and to help with forest land consolidation. So the basic point is that you've done a great job at going and picking up some of these matching funds, and hopefully we can help you at the state.
Thank you, Senator.
Senator Anderson.
Well, Mr. Chair, I was just going to make the same comment. I know we had some discussion about this, and there were a lot of requests last session. We weren't able to put that amount in, and so I really appreciate your coming back with a lot of private matching funds. So hopefully we can do the $50,000 part. We'll do our best to get there, if that'll make it happen.
Thank you, Senator.
Senator Schroeder.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. The request is for the legislature to give $50,000 to the council.
That's correct.
And the additional $50,000 will match $150,000 in private funding, and that will do what?
Blandon Foundation and Iron Range Resources. So the what it would do is make the study whole relative to our ability to extend the work that's been done in Itasca County across a broad swath of counties in northern and central Minnesota, and then look at the different policy tools that I just mentioned in terms of their applicability in reducing the adverse impacts of parcelization, And then finally, making recommendations to the legislature. So the piece from the $50,000 from the legislature would go towards completing the policy analysis portion, looking at policy tools, and then making recommendations back to the legislature relative to what seemed like the most cost-effective ways to proceed.
So, Mr. Chair, at the moment, we need to study this more?
Absolutely. Dr. Kilgore will provide you at the end of this hearing with testimony on a study that he did with the funding that we provided him. And you'll see there's some very interesting results from Itasca County. And part of the question that we have is what is occurring in Itasca County may not necessarily be occurring in Cook County or, you know, Aitkin County. And we need to look at to what extent is parcelization occurring, where is it occurring, how fast is it occurring, so that we're applying appropriate tools in appropriate places and not spending money unwisely, I guess, the way I'd say it. We have limited funds. The legislature, there's a lot of other demands, and we want to make sure funds are spent appropriately and well.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Zemeta, we did have a hearing about this last session as well, and what I took away from that was that there was a strong sense of urgency on this issue, and I haven't been involved with the working groups in this process, but I kind of thought that there might be some recommendations for this bonding cycle. Is that not going to be the case?
Senator Chaudhry, we weren't funded to do the study. We have some limited results from Itasca County that certainly are suggestive, and there's some value in that. The question is, do those results apply statewide? We don't know the answer to that until we do some empirical research in these other counties. And that is often the case with the legislature. You're forced to make decisions with, you know, limited information. You just do the best you can. Certainly, in terms of bonding, my understanding is we have $9 million in bonding for forest land conservation easements. Is that right, Senator Schatz?
Let me add to what you say here, Mr. Zemeta. Senator Chaudhry, I think as we go down the testifiers, we're going to see some of the recommendations, you know, whether it's a revolving fund out of the LCCMR, or Ms. Lewis is going to talk about some exchange law that we may indeed be putting forth. And, of course, there's the Forest Legacy, which Mr. Zemeta says will be continue to be funded and it will be requested. So in answer to your question, and it's a good one, yes, I think we are making recommendations.
Thank you.
Any other questions for Mr. Zemeta? Thank you both.
Thank
Appreciate
you.
Appreciate it. Yeah. Next, we have Kathy Lewis from DNR Lands and Minerals. How are you, Ms. Lewis?
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Kathy Lewis, Assistant Director of the Division of Lands and Minerals. And the document I'm speaking from is, it says all new language at the very top, and it starts with section 94.3495. Well, the Department of Natural Resources, as part of this issue of forest fragmentation, said, what can we do about the land exchange provisions in the law? Land exchanges have existed since the mid-40s, but it's a fairly complicated process and fairly costly. And we said if we can expedite land exchanges between units of government, it would aid in reducing forest fragmentation. It also would save management cost. And so we said, what can we do that when we look at the land exchange law? And we focused on basically two areas, the valuation of the lands and the title of the lands. And we put together some draft legislation that the department is looking at proposing as a department bill for this session. What we're doing is we take the existing land exchange laws that are found in Chapter 94, and we say what works and what should we do to expedite the process. One of the things we looked at when we look at classes of land, we said for the land that the DNR controls, we should at this point in time leave out the school trust lands and the university lands. I'll talk about that a little bit at the end of explaining why, but it's relating to our fiduciary obligations. The land exchange law covers tax forfeited lands. They're lands owned by the state and trust for the taxing districts. So a large group of these land exchanges would be between basically the DNR and the county, but you're exchanging state-owned lands for state-owned lands, but they're administered by other parties. We also would have this law also be available for the counties and cities to use, too, in their land exchanges. When we looked at the valuation of the land, one of the things that's very costly is to do a full-blown appraisal. Appraisal for a 40-acre parcel averages at least $2,500. And there's things that you can do that are less than that. We do have authorization in law to do a minimal valuation process for lower value of lands. We'd allow that to apply for land exchanges. We'd also add a new method, which is allowing a market analysis by a real estate broker. And that would provide another means to value the land that would be much less costly to do. We want to also make sure that the timber value would be considered in the valuation of the lands. Another thing that happens is you have to have the land substantially equal value. And that means under the statute, if you're greater than 100 acres, you have to be within 10% of value. And if you're less than 100 acres, you have to be within 20% of value. But what happens in the land exchange business is you have your lands identified, and then you get somewhat close, but you're not exact. And then you spend time adjusting the acreage so you can be the exact acreage. We would eliminate that adjustment that would be needed. Another factor is title. You have to prepare an abstract and it has to be reviewed by the Attorney General's office. You could shortcut that by using title insurance. We would maintain the requirement that you have to be approved by the Land Exchange Board. State Auditor Otto, who's here in the audience, is one of the members of the Land Exchange Board, also the Attorney General and the Governor. And it's in the Constitution that exchange of publicly owned lands have to go before the Land Exchange Board, and they have to have unanimous approval. Section 6 of the bill is more of a technical administrative part of the provision. But we've added another provision in the Subdivision 7 to add a reversionary right that says we want to make sure that the parties involved are serious that they're exchanging it for the purpose of forced consolidation and management. And so you can't turn around and acquire the land from the other entity and then sell the land and make money. Now, we want to have a little escape clause in case there's a trespass found or something has to be adjusted and the other party agrees to it. Otherwise, we say, you're doing this deal for the reasons you're saying, and we're putting a reversionary clause to keep you honest in there. And it works on both sides of the situation. Now, where you didn't include trust fund land, because we know that this is a little bit higher risk management than the current practice. You're doing a valuation that is not the highest standard in some cases. Title insurance is not necessarily the best thing as doing title work, because if the title is bad and you go with the title insurance and you have to collect, you get money, you don't get the land. And so when you do the work with the Attorney General's office, you're doing the very best you can with title insurance. We said, well, with our fiduciary obligations for school and trust lands, we better give this process some time to work and make sure we're taking the full protections that are needed. And if it works well, we can come back in a subsequent session and say, this is working really well, let's expand it to trust land. Or we might say, this is not enough foolproof protection to meet our fiduciary obligations, and let's not take this forward for school trust land. But that's kind of the ideas that we're thinking about, that this is another tool to help expedite exchanges, again, between local units of government, the state of Minnesota, basically exchanging state-owned lands administered by different parties, and also to help the parties move forward in the future for managing the lands with a reduction in costs for the timber sales and the border lines, all those kind of management activities. So, Mr. Chair, I'd stand for any questions that there are.
Senator Perzo.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Lewis, I'm going to ask a very elementary question because I don't know the answer, and I've never heard anybody talk about it. Does your agency also cover the land that's owned by the university down in Empire Township?
Madam Chair, Senator Purcell, the Umer, are you referring to the Umer property?
Umer, yes.
The Umer property is under an agreement between the DNR and the university. The ownership doesn't transfer for, I believe, a 25-year period. So the actual ownership doesn't transfer. There is a management agreement for that property.
See, thank you.
Other questions?
Ms.
Lewis, I think that the DNR and Itasca County and the UPM with their record land exchange for the Minnesota Steel Project in Itasca County, I thought that was amazing, and I thought all those organizations did a wonderful job. But I think some of the ideas that we're thinking about right now came about because of that. It was so large, and if we'd had to do an abstract for every piece of land, we'd still be trying to figure out what we were doing. And so this whole idea, I think you and I have both agreed that this is a little bit of low-hanging fruit. This may be the easiest thing, and it's, as you say, if it becomes a successful way of exchanging land, maybe we can do some other things too. Is that a fair statement? Or?
That's a fair statement, Mr.
Thank
Chair.
You. Thank you. Any other questions? Okay, well, thank you very much. We appreciate it, and we'll see you. Hopefully, we'll see you another time in the not-too-distant future. Next, we have Craig Engvall, who's the DNR Regional Director for Northeastern Minnesota, where most of the forests are located. Go ahead and identify yourself.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Craig Engvall, and I'm the DNR Regional Director in Grand Rapids for the Northeast region of the state. I'm here to talk about some of the tools in the toolbox we have to deal with some of the changing landscape in northern Minnesota, primarily due to recent trends in land sales, land prices, and business practices that are affecting our natural resources themselves, the public's ability to access land for hunting, recreation, and other activities, and resource managers such as DNR, county land managers, their ability to access lands to manage those lands for timber sales and other activities. These trends are happening fast, and we've got to react quickly to deal with what's going on, or otherwise that opportunity will be lost. You'll hear a lot of discussion today about the Forest Legacy Program, what it's done. It's done some tremendous things, and I think it will be the anchor to what we can do on the big scale. I'm going to speak more in detail about some other options that are necessary beyond Forest Legacy. Quickly, for Forest Legacy, we have obtained two really tremendous easements in northern Minnesota in the past year. Different style easements, one near Grand Rapids of approximately 1,700 acres that you're well aware of near Sugar Hills, and an area that was very likely to be developed soon, a higher value, higher population area, and served a wonderful purpose to preserve a ski area and habitat and hunting access, etc. The other is the Kuchiching Washington Forest Legacy easement in Kuchiching in northern Itasca County. That's different in nature, much larger, 51,000 acres, more remote, but still will do tremendous things in terms of public access, consolidation, etc., and keeping resources in the public access and timber management protected. So while Legacy is doing great things, it's not the panacea in that there are entities out there, such as Potlatch, who really aren't interested in an easement program. So we've got to have other options to go at those lands that they may choose to sell for business reasons and otherwise. And that's what led to our proposal to the LCCMR for a revolving fund that would enable us to go out and potentially make fee acquisition of some of those lands. Very briefly, I want to describe why that's necessary compared to our usual acquisition processes. We have some, and the legislature has funded and created many of those programs that are tremendous, whether it's the Wildlife Management Area Acquisition Fund or the SNA or Prairie Bank. Great programs, but they're kind of stuck in their chimneys, and they do great things, but they're not able to respond to this unique circumstance in northern Minnesota where some of these parcels are going up quickly. I have a very specific example of that, where Potlatch wanted to sell 320 acres immediately adjacent to a WMA. And once they put that in play, their real estate investment trust, when they make that decision to sell, that land has to sell within 6 months. I try to work with our wildlife management acquisition program, and the time frames and the priorities they had just didn't work well. So what we'd like to do with this is, with the LCCMR's appropriation, put that into a fund which we'd call a Land Consolidation Revolving Fund that would enable us to go out after some of these parcels quickly, and it would, I'd refer to it as a department acquisition that would be interdisciplinary. That, for instance, the way it functioned in my region is my resource managers from the different disciplines would agree that this is a key acquisition we need to make, whether it's for forestry, wildlife values, rare plants, access to public lands. This is the right thing for us to do as a department, and let's go out and do that. How it would function is that the LCCMR proposes to appropriate $500,000 that would go into our land acquisition account. We would then use that money to go out and strategically buy parcels, such as the one I mentioned, by our wildlife management area. The good thing about it is that we could then replenish that money in a couple of ways. One would be to have our managers assess what we have, look at what might be excess. We have some wildlife management areas, frankly, that through sprawl and growth and things, they have lost the purpose for which they were acquired. And we might need to look at whether we might be willing to sell some of those lands. If we do sell those lands, that money would then be deposited in this exact same account and could be used then, reused to strategically acquire lands that are at risk and of higher resource value and public value to us. The account is also able to accept gifts and donation, and we could use that money to then go out and do the same thing. So I'll probably generate questions with that, but that's the outline of the revolving fund. I just want to point out one other tool that the legislature helped us with that recently was real successful in Hubbard County. It was our pilot, and that had to do with we have thousands of state forest roads, and the counties are facing the same issue that cross private lands to access public lands, and they were never recorded in the real property records. They've been there for 50, 80, 100 years. And we recognize that problem, much like the townships ran into that same problem 25, 30 years ago. The legislature created a process where we could publish a map, give actual notice to the landowners whose land we cross with those roads, have a public hearing and process, and be very open about what our assertion as to those forest roads are and were. In Hubbard County, we had our hearing in December along with the county. Happy to say that even though we affected over 40 individual private parcels plus a number of Potlatch parcels, we came through that process and everybody agreed to the map we proposed. There was not one challenge to that process, and we are able now to record those maps, memorialize them in the public record, so we have management access, the public has access to those lands, and it worked very well. Do I think it'll be that smooth in every county? No, I don't, but it's just another part of this to preserve management and access to the public. And with that, Mr. Chair, I'd be happy to entertain any questions that you or the committee would have.
Questions about particularly about the LCCMR project that we're talking about? Or?
Mr. Chairman.
Yeah, Senator Fredericks.
Four of us on this subcommittee on the LCC.
Good. Well, you practically wrote it then, so no wonder there's no questions. Anything else? Well, that's exciting. You know, the ideas that we're talking about, again, with those exchanges, and sometimes having, as you say, to buy a fee title in order to get the easements that are needed, you know, it can all work pretty well, I think. We'll look forward to hearing more about that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Engwell. Next, we have Doug Thompson from the Nature Conservancy. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
You want to identify yourself and
yes.
Who you represent, and then go ahead.
Yep, my name's Doug Thompson. I'm the Northeast Minnesota Program Director for the Nature Conservancy out of Duluth, Minnesota, and my area covers the same area as Craig Ingalls, Northeast Minnesota, and the forested part of the state. I would like the opportunity, Mr. Chair, to highlight again the high points we've had over the past year with Forest Legacy. As you know, there has been a Forest Legacy Advisory Group made up of private and public partners with conservation interest, with a real interest in protecting the North Woods. The initial focus has been on the greater Itasca County area, which is basically Itasca County with about a 20-kilometer buffer around it. That's where we've identified a real need. There's a real checkerboard of ownership and, you know, the real heart of the industrial lands in northern Minnesota. We had an initial goal of protecting 75,000 acres and of raising $26 million. To date, in the past year, we've protected about 53,000 acres in that area. In the spring, we closed on a 1,600-acre piece in Itasca County, the Lila Forest Products land. As Craig Ingwell noted, a really high-quality, smaller piece of property. This past October, we closed on a 51 to 52,000-acre parcel, easement over 51 to 52,000 acres in both Itasca and Couchiching counties, with about 40,000 of that being in Couchiching County and 10,000 of that being in Itasca County. We recently, in partnership with we being the Nature Conservancy, the Conservation Fund, in Lake County, in partnership with the state of Minnesota, a couple of weeks ago, closed on a 6,000-acre piece in Lake County. It's outside of our focus area, but it's a very similar type of conservation easement with similar goals. We, of the $26 million we set as a goal to raise, we've secured about $10 million public, and we've secured a 14 million dollar goal of private funding. So we've had a lot of great success. We still in the greater Itasca County region have at least 23,000 acres we'd like to protect. But as with a lot of really important issues, we've come to the understanding that that's really just the beginning. There's a Forest Legacy Advisory Team that's advising the commissioner right now, helping to develop acreage goals and having us think larger picture than just the greater Itasca County area, recognizing that this is a trend that impacts the entire North Country. I personally come from the East Coast, from New York, where a lot of this this divestiture of timberland was happening, you know, a decade ago or 15 years ago. And I believe the reason that I was brought to Minnesota by the Nature Conservancy was to help strategize about addressing the issue here. The one thing I see in the state of Minnesota that I did not see on the East Coast and also on the West Coast where I've done some work is the opportunity to be ahead of the eight ball. We were not able to do that on either coast. And frankly, all of the industrial lands have been sold multiple times, turned over. We've gone nationally from 50 million acres being controlled by, you know, a dozen or so vertically integrated companies to having only about 10 million acres controlled by vertically integrated, publicly traded companies. And those companies are, if you consider the major ones, there are only two. Weyerhaeuser and Temple Inland. We expect that to change. And when it changes, we don't know. My forecast for the state of Minnesota is we have a great start on Forest Legacy, but we're going to have to be really aggressive here to stay ahead of the wave. And I would be really proud to be part of helping to do that. It's going to be really critical to maintain the public support for this program to make it work. As I noted, we had a $14 million goal of, you know, for private monies to help address this issue, and that's been a nice catalyst, but it's really going to be based on the ability of the state of Minnesota to help fund this important conservation project through bonding and dedicated funding, frankly. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Thompson. Any questions on the Forest Legacy Project? We've heard about it before, but it was one of the first tools in our toolbox that we were able to use. And tell us, since we're state government, how our Department of Natural Resources is part of Forest Legacy.
Well, the Department of Natural Resources is really the key for the administration of this program. We have a bunch of partners, a number of partners who have come together to help with the funding and help with the design of a forest legacy working forest conservation easement program. But at the end of the day, the administration of the Forest Legacy Program is going to be in the hands of the Minnesota Department of Natural Resources. And going forward, we see the Minnesota Department of Natural Resources taking more of a leadership role in not only implementation of these working forest conservation easements, but in, you know, strategizing on how to acquire these easements and actually acquiring the easements. So Minnesota DNR is the key player here long term.
Thank you. Any other questions of the committee? All right. Thank you, Mr. Thompson.
Thank you.
Next, we have the Cass County Land Commissioner, Norm Moody. And whereas most of what we've been hearing about are parts of our toolbox implementation that either are in effect or we're going to ask to put in effect, Mr. Moody is going to tell us about some of the things that are being done in Cass County, which are interested and. And since the counties have more leeway and sometimes in management, still these are things that hopefully sometime in the future we can think about. So if you identify yourself, Norman, and
thank you, Chairman, take off. Senators. I'm Norm Moody. I'm the land commissioner from Cass County. I've been there just a little over 15 years. And we're going to talk about a couple things today that fit into some of the other programs or kind of offshoots of that. In your packet, one of the things you have a history of the defragmentation that's been going on in Cass County. We tried to highlight some of the major issues that we try to impact on the landscape or on the resource. And with our land exchanges, and these are net land exchanges, they're value for value, we've increased the net gain in acres, over 600 acres, 237 of which are upland timber-producing acres. But a couple of the other key areas there, we've defragmented over 4,300 acres of land. That is, we've gotten rid of the boundaries and put them into larger parcels, be it into larger private parcels or larger public parcels. One of the key things and a major cost for us is boundary lines or property lines. We've gotten rid of 44 acres of property lines through our land exchange program. Now, our program is the land asset management. We buy lands, we trade lands, we sell lands. And sometimes when we sell them with covenants on them that require certain things of future owners, or we limit the development rights when we sell those lands. That's one of the things you can do. Something that has come up in the last few years is the change that took place when our potlatch lands, our Boise lands, our other industrial lands came out of tree growth or came out of auxiliary forest. And I don't think anybody really understood what this meant, but it's the wave that came from the east or the west. These lands are now all in play. And this became a particular concern for us because many of our lands are accessed both for timber harvest and for recreation across these industrial lands. So I sat down with Dennis Humich from Cooch. They were running into the same problem and said, we got to come up with something, and we need something fairly soon to deal with these issues. I guess personally, I'm really concerned about the loss of the industrial forest lands. We have state trust lands of various types. We have the county, which are the tax forfeited trust lands, but also one of the key elements out there that retains the industry in Minnesota is the industrial forest lands. So we came up with something that you have in your packet. It's called the Industrial Forest Land Productivity Investment and Retention Program. And we looked at it as a business plan,
How do we go at this?
Excuse me, Mr. Moody. You call that iFlip? Is that your...
Yes. We had some help in developing that. It's iFlip. It's Industrial Forest Land Investment Program. You're investing in these lands. When you invest in lands, you expect a return on these lands. We look at it as a program that's going to pay for itself in many different ways. We have to move very quickly. In fact, tomorrow morning I'm going to be negotiating on the purchase of a parcel of industrial lands that's up for sale right now. So that's how fast things are going. But the intent of the program would be that we would look at the state acquiring these lands as industrial lands. Who manages them after that? We'll worry about that later. Be it the county manages, be the state manages, but there should be a return on that investment to pay back the purchase price. Some of the other things that we considered that this program would be required to do is there would be a requirement for harvesting, and that it would be silviculturally sound harvesting. We won't be waiting until this timber becomes punky to send it to the mill. These lands should be harvested on a rotation that makes economic sense. One of the things we're beginning to understand is just the value of that public recreation. And if you ever want to test something, ask somebody what they'd be willing to lease their private land for public hunting. And usually you get a blank stare. And, well, not for any money. But I think the break-even, I know there's a study that somebody's working on, they say it comes out to about $50 an acre. So we didn't realize what we had with these industrial forest lands that were open and quasi-public lands. The benefits, you know, we're trying to lock in motorized trails right now. Well, guess where a lot of these motorized trails go? Everybody understands the ATV issue out there. Well, a lot of these trails go across these industrial private forest lands. So we need to be looking at securing those things. I guess the very best policy initiative this state could take if we want to keep the timber industry here is to get a hold of those industrial lands and keep them as industrial lands. I can't think of anything that would send a signal to the industry, not maybe to a individual company, but to the industry, that we're serious in Minnesota and we're going to have productive forest lands. The greatest threat for fragmentation right now, there's no question, it's the industrial forest land sell-off. That is the greatest threat that I see out there. I did give you a map there that, a little plat that showed you one of the acquisition exchange type operations that we go through. We did purchase this one parcel with an easement. There's actually several thousand acres of county land in there, and we acquired the other striped one also. We're exchanging those for the 42 acres over at Outing. That's the public land that really we can fragment. There's going to be more people, so where should they be? Let's put them out on the infrastructure and where they aren't going to increase the burden, the tax burden. There is no increase if they're on existing infrastructure. I always talk about return on investment. If you see that easement that we were able to acquire with the land, that's going to provide summer access to our timber up there. That's a return right now. I look at it as $5 a cord on the wood that will be bid up extra over and above, in that they don't have to go across a private landowner, and it's summer access. So it really is a business plan. We'll leave it at that. Open it for questions.
Questions. When you talk about the timber industry, Commissioner, and industrial forest lands, and going to the mill, you know, we're starting to think a little more that wood may be a source of energy too. You know, we've got Minnesota Power and their biomass. We have cellulosic biofuels that are coming along. So I mean, industrial forests are going to. Are going to be more and more important. I would hope you'd agree on that particular point.
I have it highlighted right here. I was watching my time. What I call secure the solid solar fuel. Cellulose is nothing but solid solar. You know, gas is liquid solar. The thing is, you don't end up with the problems of the greenhouse gases when you use cellulose. It just makes sense. It's part and parcel of it. Industrial lands, I don't consider it, be it roundwood, be it go to a 2x4, be it go for fuel or whatever it is. These are productive lands that you want to keep in production.
and open to the public.
And Mr. Moody, on the subject of easements and fee purchase, I remember we've talked before about the fact that rather than negotiating easements with an owner, sometimes it makes more sense to buy the piece of land, take the easement, and then sell it back to on the private market. Is that something you found successful? Or
that comes from a past life. I used to work for a very large power company, and it was always cheaper to buy the land, put the easement on. It's the same thing we found at the county level. If there's not a real interest in selling us an easement, they may be willing to sell us the land. And we have been successful in buying land, placing our easement on, and actually in some cases making money in the resale of the land, because there are other people out there that don't mind the easement but that are interested in some of the attributes that we put with the land. In one case, we actually provided a forest management plan with it. The buyer saw that as a value, that he already had the plan done, buying the land. And in some cases, you can restrict some of the fragmentation. You buy the land, you put your easement on, and then you restrict development on the land so that you don't create future problems.
And the important point there is that the government doesn't necessarily have to get any more into the land business.
No.
They can get their easements and then
we're out
put it back on the private market.
Yes. Yeah, it's basically securing the interest of the public is what we're doing.
Other questions? Thank you very much. I saw Dr. Kilgore. Dr. Kilgore, welcome.
Good afternoon. Thank you. For the record, my name is Mike Kilgore. I'm an associate professor in the Department of Forest Resources at the University of Minnesota here in the St. Paul campus. What I'd like to do for the next few minutes is just touch on a couple of studies that we have just completed or are just in the final stages of that are directly germane to the topic you're talking about here. First of all, it had been referenced by Dr. Zimetta earlier, a study of parcelization activity of forest land in Itasca County. Just want to touch on what we found there. Secondly, I want to talk about a study that we're just completing with Commissioner Moody and the other land commissioners about the sale of public lands, how the use and the management of those lands will likely change based on some data and a study that we conducted. And thirdly, I want to talk about a study that we just completed looking at the value of public recreational access to forest lands. So just to start out on the topic of parcelization, again, which is not necessarily the same as fragmentation. Parcelization is the fragmentation of ownership. You could still have a contiguous block of forest land, but instead of one owner, many. We were funded by the Minnesota Forest Resources Council a little over a year ago to conduct a study to look at parcelization activity in Itasca County. And what's interesting is if you look across the studies that have been done on parcelization, there's a lot of discussion about it, but very few studies have actually tried to measure how much of it's happening. It's hard to do. We looked at parcelization activity of 40 acres or larger parcels in Itasca County. Let me just highlight a couple of the key findings. First, and this is from 1999 to 2006, so a fairly short and a relatively recent period of time. First of all, we didn't find any increasing nor decreasing trend in parcelization, that it's fairly constant throughout that period of time from 1999 to 2006. In round numbers, about 0.4% of the county's private forest land base is parcelized, which means it's being subdivided each year. And that, with very few exceptions, is pretty constant over this period of time that we looked at it. Secondly, we found that parcelization activity is disproportionately occurring near water, near public lands, and near communities, not necessarily the large communities like Grand Rapids, but other communities. The third one, which is very important, is that we found that parcelization activity is strongly tied to development. And what I mean by that is when forest land is subdivided, we found that 2/3 of the forest land that had been subdivided between 1999 and 2000, 2 out of every 3 parcels, had a house or a cabin built on that piece of property by the year 2006. So in a very short period of time, 6 years, 2 out of every 3 parcels had a building structure. And when you do that, you start some of the benefits and uses of forest land are compromised. Could be for hunting, could be for timber production. Research has shown that the smaller the size, and when you start having development occurring, you limit those other options on the forest land, as the forestry being the highest and the best use. The last point about the parcelization study is that we found a real dichotomy in terms of where this parcelization is occurring most strongly. And I don't mean across the county, because we did find parcelization occurring in the north, in the south, and in the east and west part of the county. What I mean is that when we look at large blocks of forest land, and in Minnesota, a large block of private forest land is a couple hundred acres. We looked at discerning between those large blocks, 40 acres or larger, with the blocks that were 40 acres and being split. And what I just described to you was when we had 40-acre parcels being split, let's say, into two 20-acre parcels or four 10-acres. When we looked at the larger parcels, let's say a 200-acre parcel of forest land, we saw parcelization activity occurring, but what we saw more than compensating for that was more consolidation. In other words, the adjacent owner might be adding on to his or her ownership. So this is a clear signal that parcelization is occurring, but it's more pronounced, much more pronounced, on these smaller, relatively smaller parcels, 40 acres, where we do see it on the larger parcels, but oftentimes, more often than not, we're seeing that the adjacent owner is buying, and that could be a forest products company, it could be a hunting club, it could be an individual. So those are some of the key findings. We did this study just in Itasca County, and we picked Itasca for a variety of reasons. Obviously, it's a primary interest. It's in central Minnesota, north central Minnesota, but it has a very good data record-keeping system that allowed us to do this type of work, which is highly automated because we're going through literally every parcel of private land in the county and tracking year-by-year activity in terms of parcel splits and changes in ownership. The second study I just want to briefly touch on is a study that we're just completing for the Association of County Land Commissioners that consists of 14 counties in northern Minnesota. I'm not going to give you a lot of the details except for one piece which I think is highly relevant to your discussion. We, as part of the study, we looked at forest land that had been in public ownership, county tax forfeited ownership, management, that had been sold to the private sector, or could have been to another government entity within the last 10 years, to see how the use and the management of that land has changed from going from public ownership to largely private ownership. And the reason I'm explaining that is because if you look at the benefits and the management and use of tax-forfeited land, it's very similar to what we see on industrial forest land. Timber production is important. It's open for public hunting and recreation. A wildlife habitat is an important benefit. So some of the things we're seeing with a sale of tax-forfeited forest land that has occurred over the last 10 years, we would likely see if, in fact, the sale of industrial forest land occurred. What we found were, number one, is that the level of management activity, and we define management activity by the use of, let's say, a forest management plan, would drop considerably. In the people who bought tax-forfeited forest land, only 20% of those are interested in timber management and have a forest management plan for their property. We do know that while the level of management, kind of a timber management plan and the consultation with a forester is much lower now than it would have been if kept in public ownership, and the same thing with industrial forest land. What really won't change is the amount of wood supply provided by these lands. Our studies, not just ours, but others, have demonstrated that in Minnesota, private forest land continues to provide its share of the wood resource to the marketplace. So what you're seeing is that they're going to continue to harvest on those lands, but a lot more of that land will be harvested without the aid of either a professional forester, a forest management plan. And also we looked at the use of our timber harvesting and forest management guidelines, and we see that from our studies, maybe 30% of the private landowners that we looked at were using those on a regular basis. So the level of harvesting stewardship would likely go down. One of the key findings, and this leads to this third study that we looked at, is the loss of public recreation activity. We've done some studies at the university looking at how much land, forest land in Minnesota is posted. And through a number of studies that we have recently done in the last couple of years, a rough rule of thumb is between half and three-fourths of all of the private forest land in Minnesota is posted from public access. We did what we call a contingent valuation study about a year ago to look at the value that private landowners place on that public access right. In other words, what it would cost to buy back that right to leave that land open to public hunting or fishing. We have walking access programs in the prairies of the Dakotas and other parts. This study is looking at a similar walk-in, non-motorized recreational access to these private forest lands. And what we found is that the cost of buying back that right would be considerable. In doing the study, we presented four different payment scenarios to landowners. And just to give you a few results, when offered, and by the way, we surveyed over 1,000 private forest landowners in 14 counties in northern Minnesota. So we have a fairly rich database. What we found was that when offered $30 per acre per year to leave that land open to public hunting access, only 10% of the respondents, the family forest owners, indicated they would. And based on our data, our estimate is that to get one out of every two landowners to agree to participate in a walk-in hunter access program, again, non-motorized, it would run about $50 an acre per year to acquire back that right. So if you look at the loss of public recreational access when this industrial forest land or the tax-forfeited forest land in our study, if in fact was sold to the private sector, which we know that in 17 out of the last 18 years, over 90% of the forest land market activity consists of individuals like us. It's not corporations. It's individuals buying 40 or 80 acre parcels of forest land. When we look at the value of having to acquire back that right, it's considerable. If you look at the landowners who currently post their forest land, it would be on average around $70 an acre a year to get one out of every two of those landowners to agree to participate in a walk-in hunter access program. Extremely expensive if, in fact, that right is forfeited through the sale of either this industrial land or other lands that are open to public access. Acquiring that right back is going to be very, very costly. Mr. Chairman, with that, I will stop and stand for any questions.
Senator Frederickson.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Kilgore, why are landowners reluctant to allow walk-in hunting and recreation? I can think of a couple reasons from the agricultural zone. Number one, they just don't want people walking around their property not knowing who they are, and they're afraid of liability issues if they would get hurt on their property. And I assume the other is that they want to restrict it for solely their own recreational use.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Frederickson, you hit on two very important reasons why landowners are reluctant. As part of all these surveys, and we're really drawing on several surveys we've done of private landowners in the state, and this really mirrors national trends, the people don't own forest land. The individuals, family forest owners, don't own land to manage it for timber production. Yes, they sell timber. They sell it at a fairly high rate, but they don't own that land for timber production. They own it to recreate. They own it as a place to get away, and primarily deer hunting. But hunting is the – if you ask them a list of 12 reasons why they own forest land, number one, every study around will tell you it's because they want a place to hunt. That's the primary reason. So to give up that right – through a public walk-in access program really extinguishes the very reason they're buying that land, and that helps explain the high cost because that's why they're buying that property. Now, other studies we've done, we've looked at do they factor in the value of the timber standing on the land, you know, when they bid for that property, and our studies have found that the value of the timber really has very little, it's statistically insignificant factor determining the price they're willing to pay. They're willing to pay for that property to hunt. Other reasons besides the fact that that's their most highly prized right is that right to exclusive public hunting access. Littering is a problem. Damage to the property, liability concerns also come up very frequently in our studies as reasons why they are not willing to open that land up to public access.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Kilgore, are they more liable to open it up for hunting on an ask and permission basis so they know who is out there and how many people are going to be out there? That's been studied at all?
Mr. Chair, Senator Frederickson, yes, that in a follow-up study we looked at that very question. Kind of two dimensions. One is when you post the land, does posting the land mean absolutely no access or does it mean access under certain circumstances? And we found that even though the land may be posted, a lot of times – The landowner is simply trying to understand who the individual is or individuals are who want to access the land. Secondly, there's a huge distinction between a leasing program where the landowner has complete control over who he or she leases with for public access versus this unfettered public access right. And we found that with this uncontrolled access, there's a much larger compensation or payment that's required of the landowner simply because they have no control once they signed into that program who can access their property in comparison to a lease. So, yes, you're absolutely correct.
Other questions? Dr. Kilgore, we heard from Mr. Zemeta from the Minnesota Forest Resource Council, the people that are going to be doing or funding some of the study, and you did Itasca County. What would you visualize in terms of what we will get out of continuing our work with the other counties of the state?
Mr. Chairman, I would concur with the comments made by Dr. Zemeta that Itasca County is a big county. It's a very important county from a forestry standpoint, from a recreational standpoint, but it's one of one county in northern Minnesota. We really, it's very hard to draw conclusions based on one study over, you know, a fairly short period of time. You know, while we haven't, you know, my guess is that we would look at maybe a half a dozen or so other counties that are heavily forested in northern Minnesota, farther to the east, farther to the west, a bit south, more towards the transition zone, and maybe northern, to see if, in fact, the findings that we're seeing in Itasca County are unique to that county, or whether or not there's a trend or a pattern that we're seeing irrespective of the location in northern Minnesota. That would be probably one of the most important findings, is whether this is geographically a very isolated set of conclusions or whether we can expand what I've described to as a general condition over all of northern Minnesota.
Other questions? If not, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
I've got one more person I'd like to have come up and say a few words, and that's Bud Stone from the Grand Rapids Area Chamber of Commerce. Mr. Stone has been instrumental in forestry committees all over the northern part of the state, and I'd just like you to make some comments on what you've heard today and what you think is going on in that northern forested area.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, committee members. My name is Bud Stone. I'm the president and chief paid executive of the Grand Rapids Area Chamber of Commerce. I've been involved in forestry for the last 5 or 6 years with most of the people in this room, I think. I sit on the Forest Legacy Advisory Team for the Department of Natural Resources. I'm on the Forest Legacy Advisory Group with the Nature Conservancy. I sit on the Forest Legacy Outreach Group for grassroots support of forest legacy projects, and I'm a member in good standing of 5 different forestry affairs committees and 5 different chambers of commerce. So I do have a little experience in it. And I think that I agree with everything that was said today. We do have a very short window to work with in the Forest Legacy projects. It's a tool, one of the tools, as Mr. Engwald said, that we can use to try to reconsolidate some of the forest land that's being fragmented right now. What we're seeing in the Northland is a trend for large, large tracts of land that has been open to the public for public access, and it's been available to industry to harvest timber and to produce a lot of different products off the forest, not only just for the paper mills, but for the wood mills and for crafters and people who make reeds and lots of other birch bark things that they do. It's a lot of uses in the forest that if these lands continue to be fragmented, that it's going to be taken away. The public access piece is super critical. Dr. Kilgore talked about the people that own the land not wanting other people on it. That's a huge issue. I spend a lot of time up in the woods myself, and what we're seeing with more and more frequency is tracts of land that used to be accessible for us to get on are inaccessible now because people are buying up the frontage land of those lands and landlocking people out of county lands and state land and federal lands. I think that Again, there are a lot of different tools that could be used out there, including Forest Legacy, and I would just encourage you to move rapidly forward with this to make sure that we can conserve as much of this land as we can, because it's if you look at the population density reports that are coming forward for the future, if we don't start to put this land away today, right now, we will not have an opportunity to do it later, and it'll be gone.
Thank you, Mr. Stone. Senator Chaudhry.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. And I guess this is a question is for anyone who could potentially answer it. When we say we're preserving the land, what are we preserving it for? Are there considerations taking place within this study on what will be the allowed uses of the land once the easements are established? Or are we simply preserving this, preserving the land to be destroyed by someone else some way down the future? Once we buy up these easements, is the land actually going to be preserved?
The answer to that is is yes. Within the conservation easements, there are laws, rules, whatever you'd like to call them, that require that land to be either managed for public access, have a timber management plan on it that allows for sustainable timber management for the future, and that stewardship is done by the holders of the easements.
I see Mr. Moody has an answer as well.
Yes.
Mr. Moody, would you come up and...
The microphone.
Senator, Chairman, I hear the terms being used together, preservation and conservation. It's really conservation of the lands. You're preserving intrinsic values, but it's not like putting it in a preserve not to be used. It's to be used, and it's to produce products. It's to produce living wage jobs in northern Minnesota. It's to preserve the opportunities to the future. That's the only thing that you're preserving is that. You know, I hear a lot of people talk about saving these things for their children or their grandchildren. Well, this is your real opportunity to save something for them so that they can make decisions in the future. It's conservation. It would be the Isaac Walton model. These lands are going to be used, but they will be used sustainably and effectively.
Mr. Engvall, would you make a comment? Thank you, Mr. Stone.
Sure, and these easements can be drafted for the unique circumstances of each one. For instance, the Sugar Hills easement can be slightly different than Kuchiching George Washington easement based on practices there. But the core of them is to try to do two things. One is to preserve certain conservation values, excuse me, in perpetuity, and those are outlined in the easement itself. The second is to enable the owner to harvest timber in a sustainable, reasonable way that will provide the economic benefit to the community and provide the public access as well. So it's finding that balance and striking that balance. Just as the state is certified in how we harvest our timber, when we sell timber on our state lands, we're certified by two outside auditing agencies. They have certain expectations that they say you'll do this in a manner that will protect the environment, will provide the public access, you'll do this in a sustainable way. That's the goal of this, to do that in perpetuity. It will prevent development. It'll there are a number of tools in there. So the main core, too, is that we're purchasing the development rights so that these large-scale parcels won't be fragmented or parcelized, as Dr. Kilgore was saying. So it's a variety pack of different protections, but the key is that it's in perpetuity and that timber harvest can be completely consistent with good conservation, as Mr. Moody was saying.
Thank you, Mr. Engvall. Senator Chaudhry, I think one of the key things he just said right there was purchasing development rights. I think that's a lot of the crux of what Forest Legacy is.
I guess, Mr. Chair, We heard earlier that someone who buys a 40 and splits it up into 10 generally isn't looking to sell the timber on their land. They want to recreate on it. So the conclusion that I draw is that the forest will be better preserved under that private ownership as opposed to a parcel that has an easement on it but is subject to timber harvest. Albeit that private owner is probably going to clear maybe 1 or 2 acres for their structures, but the rest of it, a minimum of 8 and above acres of that, is they're then going to be preserved. And you know that those trees are going to get bigger. They're going to have all sorts of sequestration. And whereas opposed to an easement situation, I don't know what type of harvest is. I guess perhaps I don't know enough about sustainable timber harvesting to know that that parcel won't be clear cut at some point. Because my understanding that the clear cutting is called for at some times. So, and once you do that, then it's going to be years and years before that parcel grows back. So, I just want to clarify what the goal of these conservation easements and forest legacy is.
Mr. Chair, Senator Chaudhry, with all due respect to, and it's how you define preservation. And if you have the scenario where you've got a block of 1,000 acres of timberland, and by the way, I'm going to let somebody speak to the sustainable harvest issue because I'm not a forester. But if you've got a 1,000-acre block of forest land that has no structures on it, no development whatsoever, and you're preserving that block, there are tremendous attributes you gain, and as Mr. Epperly will tell you. If you then parcelize that and somebody comes in and wants to build a cabin and they may not harvest their timber, you're bringing in utilities, you're bringing in activity, you're bringing in a road. It's putting different strains on both the county in terms of their infrastructure, but also the land itself. So if you take that 1,000 acres and all of a sudden you've got 20 different cabin sites and 20 different cabin roads and power lines and all those things that go with it, you're having some adverse resource impacts beyond the timber value, which I'll let Mr. Epperly speak to.
Mr. Epperly, identify yourself if you would.
I'm Dave Epperly. I'm the Director of Forestry for the Minnesota DNR. Senator Soksok, Senator Chaudhry, you asked an excellent question. What exactly are you preserving? And the grand view of what you're preserving are the values and the integrity of the land itself and its capability to produce not only values but the commodities that we come to depend on from the land. In that light, if you're maintaining an integrity of a larger land base, all of the systems, all of the things that are involved with regard to that land base remain intact. They are not fragmented. And that goes to what Director Engwall was referring to as some of the fragmentations. The uses of the land and the sustainable manner for which they're used is a very key point, because if they are indeed sustainable, then you are not sacrificing one value for the other or trying to maximize one commodity over another value. And that's an important message that is in the word sustainable.
Mr. Chair, you still build roads when you harvest timber. Imagine there are some utility links as well.
Yep.
There's lots of roads going through the potlatch land up where my cabin is. And that was all done for forestry.
Senator Soksok, good.
What's the difference?
And Senator Chaudhry, another good question. Roads are an important element for all kinds of purposes. And again, to the sustainability side, you're going to optimize your ability to access without sacrificing the value of the land. And so roads, like anything else, can be overused. They can be underused. Don't necessarily, in every case, need to build a highway into a parcel of land to access it. It can be something that is temporary in nature. So the disruption will be for a specific purpose, but over time, the road might disappear. Some roads might be permanent, but that goes to the ability to maintain access for a whole host of reasons, everything from protection, such as fire protection, wildlife viewing, people to access and enjoy and use the forest.
Mr. Thompson, did you have a comment for Senator Chaudhry?
I do. I'd like to make a really specific example. These have been some big picture good answers, but to get into the heart of what's in the conservation easement, to go to Dr. Kilgore's example of parcelization versus fragmentation, that's a really great way to distinguish those two issues, which are tied together. But from the perspective of a conservation organization driven by science, like the Nature Conservancy, DNR, others, we consider fragmentation not just to be the physical cutting up of a landscape, it's the lack of unification of management in a landscape. So you can have multiple owners managing in different ways, and you end up with no rhyme or reason that fits. For example, what would mimic a historic natural disturbance in a landscape? There can be a scenario, there are many scenarios in Minnesota because of the natural disturbances being fire, that clear cutting's good. You can have a clear cut that's well designed based on where fire would have gone historically. That can be a good management plan for a site based on what had happened there historically. And per the roads, that's a great example, because if you don't have a conservation easement, you would have multiple owners building multiple roads to get to their timber or to get to their recreational spots. They wouldn't be talking to each other. They have their own interest. So you would take a landscape and fragment it even more, not just physically fragment it, but you would fragment the management of the landscape. Specifically, I wanted to come to the front here, having worked on these conservation easements very closely with DNR, and we have Dick Peterson here, who I worked closely with on a couple of the easements from the Department of Natural Resources. In the conservation easements, we put a non-forested area restriction in the working forest easement. Remember, this is in perpetuity, and everything's fluid when you're managing land. So there are going to be roads that go in, there are going to be roads that eventually are grown back over, there are going to be log landings, there are going to be in certain spots on the property, those will grow back over. But there is a non-forested area restriction that goes in these conservation easements to take that very thing, you know, the example that you made, into account. So it's a best case scenario, I believe, to have these easements and have a working forest managed in a sustainable way for the landscape in northern Minnesota. It fits.
Senator Anderson.
Thank you. Mr.
Sorry,
Chair.
Excuse me. Senator Chaudhry, are you okay?
I'll chew on these answers for a little while.
Yeah, okay. Just a brief comment I want to make, and that is that in the LCCMR, we've had a pretty vigorous discussion about how to make sure that these public dollars are being used in the best possible way if you are buying easements, and what the easements require. And we've talked a lot about trying to set standards so that we know we're getting the right kind of land protection for our money. And I mean, I think that's something we need to do more work on at the legislative level, but we've started that discussion and, you know, talked about what is allowed on these lands with the permanent easements and what isn't. And, you know, mining rights, that's a very difficult discussion, and among others, you know, should we have easements that allow for mining rights to be eventually exercised, for example? So, and what would be, how would we compensate for that expenditure? So it's something we've talked a lot about, and I think it's a good discussion, and these are really good questions, but I think we need to have standards in place to make sure that if we do fund these programs, we know we're getting bang for our buck, conservation bang for our buck.
Right. Go ahead, Senator Frederickson.
Along that theme,
same topic of what we've discussed at LCCMR. We've also talked about monitoring and enforcing easements. We have some sense that there may be some easements that were granted or purchased, you know, many years ago, and nobody's gone back and looked at them to see that the owners are complying with that easement. And we're trying to make sure that when we purchase easements that there is a checking to make sure that the landowners are complying with the easements.
Yeah.
But both Department of Natural Resources, Bowser, and any state department that buys easements.
Absolutely. That's a great point, I think, Senator Frederickson. Senator Chaudhry, did you have another question?
I guess the last question I have is, do we want or is it advisable to have uniform easement standards or some sort of model easement that is used as a best practice? And if so, is that something that's being considered as part of the Forest Resource Council study?
Mr. Engvall.
Mr. Chair, Senator Chaudhry, it's a very valid issue that we need to discuss more because I would say certainly we need guidelines because we have to get the bang for the buck. Now, the issue comes in where you have forest legacy easements in southeast Minnesota that might be 50 acres in size versus 51,000 acres in Kuchiching County and what values we're trying to preserve there. In southeast Minnesota and some of those smaller areas where we're trying to get a habitat benefit more than a public access benefit, frankly, a lot of those small easements, they're unwilling to do that, but their values we can purchase. A guideline that would mandate public access in every single easement may hurt us from a resource protection standpoint there. So it's having these discussions and working through them and seeing how they fit. And that's what we're trying to do with the Forest Legacy Advisory Team that's advising the commissioner that's going to meet after this committee hearing today with Mr. Stone and others to talk about these things and to try to come up with some recommendations and standards. But I have a concern about trying to build one-size-fits-all, and that's part of this broader discussion that we in the legislature need to continue to have.
Mr. Chair, what are your concerns with a one-size-fits-all?
As I was saying, if we say as a state, for instance, that public access for every easement is a mandate, which we are acquiring public access in the larger ones in northern Minnesota, there may be other opportunities where we can do preservation and good things in terms of habitat in other parts of the state where a landowner may not be willing to convey that easement if public access is mandated. A classic example, for instance, is I worked for years on the RIM program and the CREP program, where those programs brought tremendous benefit to the state in terms of habitat, resource protection, but they did not mandate public access. I think those were great programs, and they did great things. And if we had mandated access, we would have lost out on a lot of opportunity there. So that's just an example of where we're looking at some of the differences depending on geography, location, et cetera.
Dr. Zabana?
Mr. Chair and Senator Chaudhry, I wanted to answer your question about the council's study. We certainly would address this issue about the pros and cons of standards for easements, because there's two ways to look at it. From an accountability standpoint, makes a lot of sense that the LCCMR is looking at this and wants to make sure that these easements are, done with certain standards and applied appropriately and that there's accountability. On the other hand, an easement for 2 acres of prime real estate in the city of Minnetonka versus a 51,000-acre easement in Kuchiching County, they're going to be structured somewhat differently. And there's different reasons why you're doing them. And there's a whole, you don't want to have, as Mr. Engvall said, one size fits all. You want to have some flexibility. So these are complex issues and need to be considered carefully. And we certainly would look at this as part of what we're studying. One other point I wanted to make relative to an earlier question you asked, if you took a 40-acre parcel and divided it into 10 you know, acre parcels, and you have four different owners coming in there, and they each stick their you know, one of them puts a permanent residence in there, and another one puts a hunting cabin, and so on. As I understand it, under state law, every time you get that permanent residence in there, you draw a 500-acre circle around that house, and there's no hunting. No hunting anymore. When that was a 40-acre undeveloped parcel, you can hunt on that land, you know. And think about that in terms of the fragmentation of the landscape over time with all these different owners and sticking their houses all over the place. It's a huge amount of land, both public and private, that's no longer accessible for hunters. And that's a key consideration and one of the prime reasons why the DNR and a whole array of other interests were concerned about, you know, these industrial forest lands in particular, and to try to keep them intact in large blocks is to preserve that recreational access for the public in perpetuity, and hunting is a, you know, really key component of that. So I wanted to make that point.
Thank you, Dr. Sabata. Other questions? Senator Pearsall?
I just want to make a comment. I think there have been easements being produced and used for all different purposes all over the state for a long, long time. And so those purposes sometimes conflict with each other, just as Mr. Zapata mentioned. And I think about the one that where they're trying to do the farmland and scenic areas and farming in Dakota County, and they tax every representative, every resident in the entire county.
Right.
But obviously everybody doesn't have access to them.
Gotcha.
They're not close enough. So there's so many different purposes, they have to be a variety.
Right. All right, other questions? I'd like to thank everybody for participating, senators, testifiers, everybody else. I think we've answered some questions today, and we probably raised a few that will continue to need work. So with that, I'm going to adjourn the meeting. Thank you very much.